Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihare. Gopi Janna Balabha Giravare Hari. Gopi Janna Balabha Giravare Hari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjanaya. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjanaya. Yamuna Tira Vanacharya. Yamuna Tira Vanacharya. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Viharya. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Bhavraj Kada Tara Satara Sada Shri Shimada Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON founder Charya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutalaya Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tanamane Namaste Saswatim Gaur Vani Bhitrani Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatari Sitarne Jai Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. Well, this is the verse we're going to be speaking about today from the Bhagavad Gita, but just as a little intro to that, I was thinking today about some experiences I had a few years ago giving programs, giving programs at Lakeland College. There was a professor there, a philosophy professor, and he had this club where he had different people come and give different talks on different philosophical subjects or different religions or like that. And, you know, it was a nice group of people, about 50 or 60 students would come. So I did that two or three years in a row. And the thing that I thought was very interesting was the main questions after I did my presentation, the students there, they were not yet devotees, were all about karma and reincarnation. They were fascinated by that, and I guess they thought the Hare Krishnas were somewhat experts on that area, so they had all these questions, like, and it was sort of down to the, well, what happens if this happens, or what do you think I'll become in my next, and I finally had to say to them, it's very hard for me to say what is your exact destination, or what will happen with any particular person in any particular circumstances. Why? Because the Bhagavad Gita tells us, 4:17, that the intricacies of action, or karma, are very difficult to understand, very hard to understand. It's very intertwined. You know, you have all of your positive, all of your negative, you have lifetime. You know, it's something that, you know, we really can hardly comprehend. But what we do understand is the general principles. And that's what I tried to tell them. This is basically the understanding of what happens. And we have great examples in our scriptures and even applications of the principles of karma and reincarnation. And one of the very best sources or the very best verses, of course, one familiar to many of you, is 8:6 of Bhagavad Gita. But before they do that, I also want to read 8:5, which kind of sets the tone a little bit. 8:5 is, whoever at the end of his life quits his body remembering me alone it once attains my nature. Of this, there is no doubt. This is Krishna speaking to Arjuna, saying, if you remember me at the end of life, you'll come back to me. You'll get out of this material world. Now, 8.6 kind of takes a step back and says, this is the general principle of what happens with everybody. So we could do this one. Yang yang vapi smaran bhavam. Twajajante kalevaram. Tang tang eva tikonteya. Sadat bhava bhavita. Yang yang vapi smaran bhavam. Twajajante kalevaram. Tang tang eva tikonteya. Sadat bhava bhavita. So the translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. So Srila Prabhupada comments on this verse. He says, the process of changing one's nature at the critical moment of death is here explained. A person who at the end of his life quits his body thinking of Krishna attains the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord. But it is not true that a person who thinks of something other than Krishna attains the same transcendental state. This is a point we should note very carefully. How can one die in a proper state of mind? Maharaj Bharata, although a great personality, thought of a deer at the end of his life, and so in his next life he was transferred into the body of a deer. Although as a deer, he remembered his past activities. He had to accept that animal body. Of course, one's thoughts during the course of one's life accumulate to influence one's thoughts at the moment of death, so this life creates one's next life. This is one of the most important sentences here, this purport, I think. I'm going to read it again. Of course, one's thoughts during the course of one's life accumulate to influence one's thoughts at the moment of death, so this life creates one's next life. If in one's present life one lives in the mode of goodness and always thinks of Krishna, it is possible for one to remember Krishna at the end of one's life. That will help one be transferred to the transcendental nature of Krishna. If one is transcendentally absorbed in Krishna's service, then his next body will be transcendental or spiritual, not material. Therefore, the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, is the best process for successfully changing one's state of being at the end of one's life. Om Gyanatim Randasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksarul Mitamina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shiva Siddhi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namosite Tapta Kanchana Gaurange Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamame Hare Pare Vanchakopa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyebacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So there are three main points that are illustrated by these two verses and by this very, very succinct and very nicely presented purport by Srila Prabhupada. First, that one's consciousness at the time of death will determine one's next life, one's next birth. Secondly, one who thinks of Krishna at the time of death returns to Krishna. And thirdly, one's consciousness throughout one's lifetime will determine that consciousness at the moment of death. Now, Prabhupada gives the example of Maharaj Bharat. And the three births of Maharaj Bharat are a very wonderful example that illustrates these principles of how reincarnation works. Maharaj Bharat, in his first life, as related in the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, was a very great devotee king. He was the son of Rishabhdev, and was a very, very righteous king, very spiritual devotee of Krishna. And finally, at the end of the life, he renounced everything. He gave up his whole kingdom. He gave up all of his riches, his family, and he went to the forest to retire as a simple mendicant, a simple practitioner of Krishna consciousness, as one should do at the end of one's life. Now, it happened that while he was doing all of his different spiritual practices, he happened to see a mother deer die suddenly and leave her young fawn. So, being compassionate, naturally, he was a little bit concerned, and so he started to care for the deer and make sure that it was all right. But then it kind of grew and expanded from that, where he was taking care of the deer constantly, and then he started always thinking of the deer, and then the deer became like his best friend, practically, him and his deer there out in the woods together. And actually, his spiritual practices began to slip. He began to pay less and less attention to the spiritual practices, which he had so much perfected, and was just absorbed in the thoughts of this deer. Well, naturally, death comes. He was elderly, and death comes upon everyone at a certain point, and guess what he thought about? The deer. He was thinking of the deer that was next to him as he passed away. So, at the time of the death, thinking of the deer, according to what we just read in Bhagavad Gita 8.6, he became a deer in his next life. But he took this birth of a deer because that was what his consciousness was. But he had accumulated many, many, you know, great pious activities and, you know, spiritual activities during his life. So he was granted full consciousness. And he had full consciousness like as if he was a human being, I guess. And he remembered all of his past activities and his past lives. So he was, of course, very sorry for what happened. He's thinking, gosh, my gosh, how am I? Here I am in this deer body. Look what happened to me. But he went to the deer went and over to the hermitages of the sages and where they were discussing, you know, of course, spiritual topics and Bhagavad. Many, you know, I guess, I don't know, deer would just go up and by there where they were encamped or whatever and just sit there. And so he got the association of those devotees. And of course, after that, after the deer passed away, he took his third life, as related, and this was as Jada Bharat. And Jada Bharat was born in a Brahmin family. He was actually a very, very intelligent, great devotee, but he was so, at this point, so afraid of material attachment that he just pretended practically just to be like deaf and dumb and mute and, you know, like a almost like developmentally disabled, I guess you'd say. You know, he had no intelligence or whatever, although this wasn't actually the case. And he was just extremely tolerant of whatever happened to him. In fact, he was one day, I'm skipping a lot of parts of the story. This is several chapters in the Bhagavatam. But one day, he's walking along, and King Rahugana has his palanquin bearers, and he needed, somebody got hurt, I don't know what happened, but they needed another one. What, you have to have at least four, I guess, one on each end. And so he was a pretty strong young man. At the time, his bodily was strong, and so they grabbed him and said, here, you carry the king. Okay. He just, you know, accepted. But he wasn't very good at it because every time there were ants, he would stop and either wait for the ants or try to step over the ants. He didn't want to kill even an ant. So, you know, the king, Rahugana, said, what's going on up there with this guy? He said, you know, get with it, you know, or whatever. So finally, and it kept happening. So finally he stopped, and he was very angry, and he chastised Jada Bharat. And then Jada Bharat spoke. And he finally gave up this pretense as a, you know, this mute, very foolish, you know, person or whatever, and spoke the most transcendental philosophy. And he kind of chastised Maharaj Rahugana, of what his proper role should be as a king and what he should be and how he was not, you know, utilizing his life properly. And Maharaj Rahugana was intelligent enough and had some pious credit that he thought, oh my gosh, this is a great personality. And he felt very sorry that he treated him that way. And he listened to him. He accepted him almost like a spiritual master at that point. And he spoke a very nice philosophy. And of course, Jada Bharat then, at the end of that lifetime, went back to Godhead. So we see these things are illustrated by a story like this, the process of samsara and the process of transmigration goes on. And as you can see, it's complicated, because we could say, well, he thought of a deer, therefore he became a deer, but not quite that simple, because he also had all these pious credits, so, you know, he got some benefit from that, he got human consciousness, you know, and he got the opportunity then to finish up his business and see Krishna at the end of his third life. Another nice purport by Srila Prabhupada, he explains a little more detail how this process of transmigration works. This is from a purport 7.13.30. If one does not act for the satisfaction of Krishna, he must be entangled in the reactions of fruitive activity. By pious activity, one is elevated to the higher planetary systems, and by impious activities, one is degraded to the lower species of life, in which he is punished by the laws of nature. In the lower species of life, there's an evolutionary process. And when the terms of the living entity's imprisonment or punishment in the lower species is finished, he is again offered a human form and given a chance to decide for himself which way he should plan. If he again misses the opportunity, he is again put into the cycle of birth and death, going sometimes higher and sometimes lower, turning on the samsara chakra, the wheel of material existence. Some really important points here. First of all, Prabhupada talks about the evolutionary process. So, do we believe in evolution? Well, yes, in a certain sense, but it's spiritual evolution. It's not material evolution, in that, you know, the species one changed to another necessarily. Exactly how all that happened and how that works, I don't even want to get into. I'm not really sure myself if I could even explain it from a spiritual perspective. But we do know there is an individual evolution of the spirit soul as one progresses from lower species of life to higher, up to the human form of life. Now, the other point that Prabhupada's making is that one can also go downward. Sometimes people mistakenly think, oh, I'll just keep, you know, evolving. You know, not necessarily. And in fact, it is only in the human form of life that we really have option. In the human form of life, the spirit soul is able to exhibit free will. We can exhibit some discrimination, some free will. We have some intelligence to know what is wrong, what we should do, what we shouldn't do, how to listen to good instruction or to ignore good instruction. That is within our power. The dog doesn't have that. The tree doesn't have that. They are more or less living out the karmic results from the past decisions made as a human being. So in other words, if one is really does all sorts of sinful activity as a human being, one will go back into those lower species. If one does very good activities, one gets a higher birth. So that is the evolutionary process. So we transmigrate through many, many bodily forms. And as I said, it's not necessarily, it's always up. It could be up, it could be down, it could be plants, it could be animals, it could be amoeba. There are 8,400,000 species of life. So one can go upward or downward from the amoeba to the position of Lord Brahma, the creator of the material universe. But the point is that all of this up and down and different species of life, sometimes people, you know, think in some sort of sentimental way, oh, that'd be kind of fun. Maybe I'll be this animal. Maybe I'll be that. No, it's not fun. It really isn't. It's really miserable. If you actually look carefully at the lives of many animals, or you know, that you see, it's not a really great life. I mean, they're all out there in the rain, or they're just huddling there, or they're trying to get eaten by some bigger animal. You know, it's you know, this hard struggle for existence is going on. You know, and it's there in the animal kingdom. It's there in the plant life. All the, you know, even within, you look out on a lawn. All the roots are competing with one another for the nutrients that are there. And then in the course, in when it gets into higher stages of consciousness, in the human form of life, I don't have to even tell you how there's so many things that cause misery for human beings. In fact, human beings are expert at causing each other misery, it seems. So all of this is going on, and people are suffering all of these things. So the material existence is compared to an ocean of misery. Srimad Bhagavatam 10.63.40 says, Unmanjanti namajanti prasakta vijanar nave. We are submerging and rising in the ocean of misery. And in the purport to that, Sridhar Swami, one of our early commentators, I think probably the first commentator, wasn't he? Well, I guess Madhvacharya was probably the first commentator in Bhagavatam, and Sridhar Swami. When was Sridhar Swami? About 1300s, anybody know? Yeah, about that, way back. Okay, anyway, Sridhar Swami said, the rising of the ocean means obtaining a higher form of life, and the submerging means going down to lower forms. So you can almost see this image of going up and down in the ocean, like gasping for air, you know, and then you get pulled down again, you know, and it's like, you know, you're almost out of breath and you come up again. That's kind of a vivid description of material life. So we do not want to continue this cycle of samsara, going up and down through one species of life after another. The whole purpose of life is to get out of this, to come back to Krishna, to realize our loving relationship with God, with Krishna, and go back to the spiritual world with Him. So all of this misery in the material life, Krishna, Prabhupada also explains in that purport, Krishna is not responsible in a sense, not directly. Indirectly, yes, because everything goes on by Krishna's will. Krishna is, of course, you know, responsible for everything. There's not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Lord. But Krishna is not responsible for the bad choices we make in this material world that causes further suffering. We receive our body due to the laws of nature and our actions and the subsequent karmic reactions to those actions. And through those activities, we create bodies by developing the consciousness that goes along with that. So while Krishna creates the laws of nature, everything is ultimately under his control, but the soul or the Atma has limited free will and is able to make choice. So, right? We all have the ability to make choice. I mean, even when you think about it, our whole social fabric is based upon the idea that people have some free will. They can make some choice. Otherwise, how could you take someone to court and say you're a criminal, that you did this and you should be punished, if you had no free will? In other words, it's recognized by everybody, you know, that yeah, we do have some choices. We do make choices. We have free will, and we act upon that. Now, sometimes the laws of nature seem so strong and a person may be so covered into it, it's almost as though they have no choice. But, you know, still, it is there to some degree. So we understand, of course, that all of these changes ultimately do not affect us, the soul. They only affect the body. The soul is traveling through these different bodies one after another. Prabhupada says, although the body is obtained and lost in due course of time, the spirit soul is not actually mixed with the body. The soul is obviously within the body, but it is not of the body. It always remains pure, a part and parcel of Krishna, but it becomes covered over in connection with the material energy in this material world. So what happens at the time of death is the soul is carried on the subtle body. Of course, this gross body is made of earth, water, fire, air, and ether, but we also have the subtle body of mind, intelligence, and ego. And so that actually continues. At time of death, that subtle body, the mind, intelligence, everything, continues onward to the next body, and the soul is carried with it, enters into the next body, and then gives life, you know, to that body. So thus, our current consciousness prepares the future body. But there is a continuity of consciousness that goes from this body to the next, how the soul is carried from one to another. This continuity of consciousness is something that we can even experience, even in this one life, when you think about it. In psychology, There's many things psychologists study. One area is one of identity. And in psychology, they call this the self. What we call the soul or the Atma or the Jiva, they say is the self. Although they're not really clear, I think they confuse the mind and intelligence. You know, they kind of mix it all up there with the self and don't have a real clear conception of it. But still, there is this idea that everyone has a self. And the self is constant, at least in this one life, they think. Now, there's two parts of that continuity of the self. One is the continuity of the self, that the self continues across time, and secondly, the self is unique. So we experience that. We perceive that we are the same self at every age. You all remember when you were a child, probably. You remember when you were a young person, a teenager. Remember when you were a young person, a middle-aged person. Now maybe some of us remember being an older person. You know, but was that us? Yeah, of course. We'd all say, yes, that was me in that particular body. And you can kind of even remember a little bit about how you felt and thought about things and like that. So some of those things change, but the identity is always there. And of course, it's obvious that we have our identity, which is separate from everybody else's. You know, we can know each other to some degree. We can know other living entities, other human beings, you know, to some degree, but not 100%, not totally, because we all are separate to some degree. We all are separate living entities. And so that is, so those two parts of the self are there. And that's as we understand that it's very similar in Krishna consciousness. The difference is, of course, that we also understand that self has continuity across lifetimes, from this lifetime into the next lifetime. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's very first teaching to Arjuna is what? In the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, after some introduction, when Krishna begins to speak, the very first verse Krishna speaks is 2:12, right? He says, "Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be." So that's the very first teaching that Krishna gives to Arjuna. You are always eternal. I'm always eternal. All these other kings, all these other separate living entities are all eternal. They all exist in the past, they all exist in now, and they will exist in the future. That means that each soul is eternal. Eternal without beginning is beginningless and endless. Therefore, if each one is separate, has a separate existence, that means, you know, there's no merging all together or any. In other words, Mayavadi philosophy is pretty much defeated in this first verse of Bhagavad Gita. You know, in other words, it's not that, you know, all the souls come together, or all the souls come together with God, all the souls become God. Krishna doesn't say that. Krishna says, "I am eternal in my position as Krishna. You're eternal in your position, and so is everyone else here." Now, people may go through different bodies, and that's where there's confusion, because there's not always clarity in the difference between the soul and the body. But if one understands that, then it becomes fairly easy to understand that there can be change of body, different bodies, but the same pure spirit soul is within. So the consciousness forms around that specific subtle body. The spirit soul is carried in the subtle body to the next gross body. And then entering that body, the soul gives life to it. Prabhupada often would say, he'd give the example, what's the difference between a living body and a dead body? They look the same thing. It's the same body, same chemicals, same parts, everything. The difference is the presence of the soul. When the soul leaves the body, there's no life. And no one's very attracted to a body with no life, are they? I mean, people really don't like dead bodies because the soul is gone. The soul is what gives life, which gives attractiveness, which gives everything. All of our happiness, all of our sensations, everything is because of the presence of the soul. So the jiva has choice. Krishna's directing the whole process, but we do have those choices. Krishna says, well, Bhagavad Gita says, the Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities. We're seated as on a machine made of material energy, 1861. So Krishna's there, directing everyone. The question is, do we listen to Krishna's direction? That's kind of the problem. We often don't. We don't listen to Krishna's direction. We follow our own dictations of our own mind, of our own ideas, rather than the ideas, than what the absolute truth that Krishna gives us in the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, etc. So I guess the takeaway here is the need for spiritual practice and consciousness throughout this lifetime. If we want to have a good next life, we want to get out of this material world, we want to be with Krishna, we want to progress in spiritual life, then we need to practice this lifetime. Again, from the purport today, Prabhupada said, one's thoughts during the course of one's life accumulate to influence one's thoughts at the moment of death. So this life creates one next life. If in one's present life one lives in the mode of goodness and thinks of Krishna, it's possible to remember Krishna at the end of life. Okay, I have some more here, but I see we're really out of time. Okay, so I'm just going to, the final thought I wanted to end with is, well, what happens at the end of life? We're talking about the end of life, what happens afterwards, but the end of life can be difficult for many people. But hopefully, if we've been practicing spiritual life throughout our life for as much time as we've had to, then it's much easier. There's much more satisfaction, there's much more peace, there's much more happiness for one who has a spiritual strength, spiritual background. And we had such a wonderful example from Srila Prabhupada, because Prabhupada was with us really from 70 to 81 years of age. And Prabhupada, from the bodily perspective, wasn't real healthy. He had all sorts of issues, like everyone else does, diseases, issues. He had a couple strokes, you might remember. But he served Krishna 100%. And he never, ever, he never stopped that. You know, his consciousness was always there, completely absorbed in Krishna. And he showed us how to transcend the material and how to remember Krishna at the end of life. So we have this wonderful example. It's Prabhupada's disappearance coming up Saturday. So it's another time to reflect upon, not that it's a happy occasion, but it certainly is an instructive occasion. His Prabhupada was, so wonderfully instructed us in everything in life and even in death. Okay. So, Srila Prabhupada says at the end of the purport, the best process to assure success in one's next life is very simple, of chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Okay. I'll stop at that point. All glories to Prabhupada. Any questions, comments, thoughts? Mother Sukada? Or, okay. I guess he'll go ahead.
Tamara Prabhu, quick question. I feel like, is there like a battle between our pious activities and what we think at the time of death? And I'm going to give two examples. The sage who was thinking of the deer at the time of his death, he had a lot of pious activity, but yet he took a lower birth because he was thinking of a deer at the end of his life. And then Putana, who was doing a lot of impious activities, killing children and killing babies, she was thinking of Krishna at the time of her death, and she got the position of the mother in the spiritual world. So she got a higher birth, even though she had impious activities, but she was thinking of Krishna at the end.
Right.
So is there like a battle between our pious or impious activities versus what we think at the end of death?
Well, I don't know if battle is quite the word for it, but both are there. And it's a balance between pious and impious. But the main thing for a devotee is remembrance of Krishna. thinking of Krishna. And of course, if one is impious one's entire life, it'll be more difficult, you know, to think of Krishna. But it's not like sometimes, you know, devotees they worry about what will happen if I don't think of, you know, it's not a trick. You know, Krishna's not going to trick us. In fact, Prabhupada said, if for some reason, sometimes it's very difficult at the end of life, you know, because of you might be in great pain or overwhelmed by so many bodily conditions. He said, even if you do not think of Krishna, Krishna will force himself into your mind. Krishna will be there. Krishna will remember us, even if we don't, if we can't remember him at the time of death. You know, if we have served Krishna nicely throughout our life. So that's the main thing.
Thank you.
Sukhita, over here, had a question.
I was just reflecting that often, you know, God or Krishna is perceived as someone who's very punitive. I know that's the image or the concept that I grew up with, you know, that if you did this, then this was going to happen. But it seems like desire plays such a significant part in what happens. You know, it's like if someone wants to use their life mainly for sleeping, they have that desire. Krishna said, okay, well, here's a bear body. You can sleep for so many months out of the year. Correct? Desire is kind of what drives all of us to where we
are. Yeah, desire is there. And then, of course, we also have we have the examples of how by their desires people, you know, do create their own circumstances. And then you also have, though, the mercy of Krishna and mercy of the devotees also interwoven in there, which is interesting. We've been, you know, reading, you know, hearing the Dhammadharastakam every day. And verse 7 is about, you know, Nalakuvara and Manigriva. And they're a really interesting example of what we're talking about because, you know, they were frolicking, whatever they were doing, playing with young women. They were naked, basically, when Narada Muni comes by. So he curses them to stand as trees. Why? Because a tree has to stand there naked. Since they wanted to do that, they didn't even have the good sense to cover themselves up when a great sage, great saint was coming by, you know. But by his mercy, they were able to be in the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj and see all the pastimes of Krishna and then be liberated by Krishna. You know, so they got a, you know, they got a wonderful destination. And the Putana was mentioned. Putana is mentioned a lot by our acharyas. It seems to be an example that's used all the time, you know, by the Goswamis because they see it as an example of Krishna's great mercy, right? She wanted to poison Krishna, to kill Krishna. How much worse can you be wanting to kill God? But because she approached him as a mother, he accepted that. It's like he ignored that she's poisoning him and accepted that she was coming as a nurse. And so, therefore, she got a Vatsalya Ras liberation. You know, of course, these are, you know, these are very special. Some of these are very special circumstances, but, you know, interesting. Okay, anything else? Yes, Prabhu?
Hare Krishna, thank you for the class. Hare Krishna. So on the topic of the spiritual evolution, do we start off with the lower forms of life in the beginning and kind of evolve our way to a human form, or do we start as a human and then from there kind of go up or down based on our choices?
That's a good question. I've sort of heard different. Once I heard the Prabhupada, didn't Prabhupada say once that we start as Lord Brahma? You know, hear that when you come in, you know. So another way.
Bhagavatam says nine-gated city.
There you go.
Nine-gated city is Brahma to all the human, not any nine-gated city. Nine gates.
Nine gates.
Who knows, two eyes, ears.
Oh, nine gates. Right, right. Because that's where you have the opportunity actually to create karma. In other words, you have choice. It'd almost be unfair to start as an animal that really can't make any choices or like that. So actually, human beings have the opportunity, right from the beginning, you know, to be able to try to elevate themselves. Unfortunately, once we're in this material energy, it seems like it's really difficult, and we stay here a long time, according to the scriptures, you know. We've all been here, you know, through quite a few lifetimes. So, you know, Prabhupada, you know, I remember, you know, when you hear some of his older lectures, how many times did Prabhupada say something like at the end of one of his lectures, now that you have this valuable human form of life, right, now is the time to just this one lifetime used, get out, you know. No, use this one lifetime.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Adhikarta.
Yeah, as far as the independence of the jiva, once you come to the material world, I heard a good example that, you know, when you're on a plane, you're going to New York or wherever you're going, and, you know, your karma is carrying you somewhere, so you can't get off the plane. You can't really change your karma once you have karma. But while you're on the plane, you have minute little decisions you can make. You can, you know, read a paper or watch a movie or talk to someone or whatever else. But, you know, the plane's going somewhere, so you have your karma. You're going to get there. Of course, the only way you can get off the plane is to chant Hare Krishna.
Yeah.
You understand?
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you all very much. Jai Prabhupada.